Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're following events out of New York and New Jersey today in connection with the discovery of bombs in both states. A suspect, Ahmad Khan Rahami, who is a 28-year-old who was born in Afghanistan but is a naturalized citizen of the United States, is in custody at this hour after a shootout with police today in Linden, New Jersey. President Obama said today that the New York and New Jersey bombs do not appear to be related to the weekend stabbing at a mall in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
Nine people were stabbed in that attack, and the FBI is treating it as a potential act of terrorism. The incident happened Saturday night when a 22-year-old Somali man dressed as a private security guard entered the Crossroads Center Mall with what looked like a kitchen knife. Now, a news agency linked to ISIS claimed the suspect as a soldier of the Islamic State. Here's St. Cloud Police Chief Blair Anderson on Saturday.
That individual made some references to Allah, and we have confirmed that he asked at least one person if they were Muslim before he assaulted them.
Police say none of the nine stabbed are suffering life-threatening injuries. For the latest, I'm joined by reporter Tim Nelson of Minnesota Public Radio. Tim, first of all, walk us through this. Give us a brief timeline about how this attack unfolded.
Well, you've gone through a lot of the detail here. This happened about 8 o'clock in St. Cloud, Minnesota. It's a regional center, a city of just under 70,000. And this Crossroads Center Mall is one of the biggest shopping malls in Minnesota outside of the Twin Cities. And, you know, this is just a regular night of shopping there when this assailant walked in and started attacking people. As you said, there were nine victims. That was seven men, one woman, and a teenage girl.
Now, you've spoken to people who were in the mall on Saturday night. What did they say? What did they tell you?
Well, we haven't been able to actually reach any of the victims themselves. They've all been discharged from the hospital. But we've been in contact with some of the people who were in the mall who described just chaos as people were screaming and running away from the attack. My colleague Matt Sepik interviewed one witness who said he actually saw the assailant stab one of the victims in the head before he fled with his own children. He feared there might be more attackers in the mall yet, and he grabbed his kids and ran out the door.
Now, I understand that an off-duty officer is the person who brought this attack to an end. What happened?
That's right. That's Jason Falconer. He's a former police chief in a nearby town and a part-time officer in another city. Now, he was off-duty at the mall just shopping. St. Cloud Mayor Dave Kleiss said yesterday that a video from the Macy's store in the mall shows the attacker approaching Falconer in the store with a knife in hand. Falconer told the suspect to stop, and he initially went down, then leapt up and lunged at this part-time officer. The suspect fell when Falconer shot him, but he got back up, and Falconer kept shooting until the suspect was finally dead. Now, we believe he's a firearms expert. He's listed as a president of a firearms training firm near St. Cloud and a competitive handgun shooter. So it appears that this assailant happened upon an extremely skilled and armed law enforcement professional who happened to be shopping Saturday night.
Wow. Well, about the assailant, about the suspect, he has been identified by his father. Tell us more.
He's been identified by a number of people who knew him as Dahir Aden. We believe he's part of a sizable immigrant community in the St. Cloud area. And among the 30,000 or so Somali Americans living in Minnesota, we think he went to high school in the area and maybe some college classes. The AP is reporting he had worked as a guard for a firm providing security for one of the stores in the mall, but only through this summer. But the FBI and a joint terrorism task force are looking into his background, so we may find out more as time goes on here.
Now, Tim, in the minute or so that we have, you mentioned the sizable immigrant community, very large Somali community. How are they reacting?
Well, this is a very difficult time. This comes on the heels of more than a half dozen Somali youth have recently pleaded guilty or been found guilty of trying to enlist with ISIS in this long-running terrorism investigation by federal authorities here in the Twin Cities. These young men tried to go to Turkey or Syria to fight with ISIS, and authorities believe some may have actually done just that, and they're still wanted. So there's that, and there's been some long simmering tensions in St. Cloud between the Somali community and others. You know, this is a historically staunchly Catholic community and one of the most conservative areas in the state. There have been literally years of ecumenical efforts to improve the relationships between St. Cloud and this mostly immigrant community, but you know, within hours of the attack yesterday, ISIS issued this statement, and it I think it strikes a new chord of fear in St. Cloud.
Tim Nelson is with Minnesota Public Radio. Tim, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, this could be the week that the Federal Reserve increases interest rates for the first time since last December after nearly 7 years at zero. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She's with us from New York. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And what are your thoughts at this point about how likely it is that the Fed will do it this week and increase interest rates?
I don't think it's likely this week. You know, we got just a mediocre jobs report in August. We have had somewhat weaker than expected retail sales recently and manufacturing data pretty soft. I think the Fed would much prefer to err on the side of caution and do nothing at this meeting. Right now, the bond traders are basically putting that the probability of a rate increase at just 20% or so.
And what are the risks of that if they don't raise interest rates right now and wait perhaps until December? What are the people who say they should be raising interest rates now saying about what could happen to the economy?
You know, what the big problem that the Fed faces is not what was once the traditional problem, which is you wait too long and you're going to foster inflation. That was always the worry. Well, we have very low inflation right now, and sure, it's ticking up a little bit, but I don't think that's the main concern. I think that the real issue here is twofold. One is that if the Fed waits too long, is it actually fostering an asset bubble? Maybe the stock market or commercial real estate has been one that we've been hearing quite a bit about lately. And that gets a little bit nerve-wracking because, you know, we hear bubbles and we think back to 2008, 2009. And if the bubble were to burst right now and rates are still so low, what does the Fed have in its toolkit? And that's the other part of the problem, which is many analysts say, unless the Fed starts to normalize rates, when something goes wrong in the economy, they just don't have as many tools available to them with rates really low.
On the other hand, what are the advocates of keeping rates low saying about why that's necessary?
A lot of economists are saying that we just don't have strong growth. I mean, look to the beginning of this year, the first half of this year, growth in the U.S., GDP, 1% annualized. That is not great. And even if we've seen a pickup here in the third quarter, there's no runaway growth that's going on. There are some who say that it's just too fragile a recovery to risk it. There's also some concern that the Fed raising rates as all the other central banks in the world are keeping their rates low or pumping new stimulus into their local economies could really mess up currency trading, and that could be very destabilizing. We saw some of that effect earlier this year. That's when the stock market corrected this year. I think that there is some belief that raising rates right now as the ECB, Bank of England, Bank of Japan, all putting stimulus into their economies could be somewhat destabilizing for global financial markets.
There are also criticisms of the Fed coming even from Donald Trump that Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, is being political about her decision not to raise interest rates up until this point or only one increase since the financial crisis, that she is trying to help the Democrats by keeping the economy going in this way.
Yeah, I don't see it being a political issue. I really don't. You know, if you look at sort of big Democratic economists, someone like a Larry Summers, right, who was a former Treasury Secretary, he's been critical of the Fed for raising rates even once. So there's clearly a rationale for keeping rates low. And frankly, I mean, is really the whole reason the economy's growing at this whopping 2% annualized basis the Fed? I think that's a tough case to make. I think maybe helpful, but not the only thing. I may be naive in this. I just don't believe Fed officials are very political.
And Jill, what about if people are listening at home and they're hearing what you're saying about what might or might not happen this week? Does it matter? Should people make any changes to their own portfolios?
You know, I always laugh because, you know, for the past umpteen months in a row, I've basically come on and said, Fed is very important, and people are very bored by this. However, before your eyes glaze over, I do want to remind you the Fed has probably the most significant impact on our financial lives than anything or any other body that's out there. You know, beyond the overall economy, we know that ultra-low rates have been really good for borrowers, right? I mean, you've seen people who are small business owners be able to borrow at cheap rates. We see people being able to refinance their homes or buying new ones. That's great news. Auto loans are pretty cheap, so that's good. But, you know, it's very frustrating when you hear about low rates if you're someone on a fixed income. And I think that my main concern right now when you ask about investors is not so much that you should do anything. I may be somewhat fearful of what you may have already done. So if you were a frustrated investor and you said, oh, I just can't get anything from my fixed investments, I'm going to shift more money into the stock market, I would be very careful. I think that people may be forgetting a little bit how scary a stock market drop can be. Please, before you make that jump and pull your hair out and say, oh, I hate these low rates, be very thoughtful about what risk would do to you and how you could really stomach the ups and downs in the future.
Jill Schlesinger, a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
All this week, we're looking at the issue of climate change, how cities are dealing with it, how humans and animals will be affected by it, and today, the science of it. Physicist Joseph Rome is author of the book Climate Change, What Everyone Needs to Know. And Joseph Rome, in your book, you write, climate change will have a bigger impact on your family and friends and all of humanity than the internet has had. Really?
Oh, absolutely. 25 years ago, if you could have known what we know today about the internet, you and your family could have made a whole lot of decisions about what to study and where to invest and all that would have, transformed your lives. And we have, with a pretty high degree of certainty, an understanding of what's going to happen over the next 25 years, both on the impacts of climate change, as well as what the energy revolution that we're now undergoing that is going to transform people's lives.
And how much of the transformation is already happening to our lives and how much hasn't happened yet and we'll notice later?
Well, we're seeing more and more extreme events. That's we're seeing droughts that used to maybe last 1 or 2 years. We see California having this worst drought in 1,200 years, and it's into its fifth year. More superstorms, more super blizzards, more super droughts, or super heat waves like we saw this summer. This is going to be the hottest year on record. NASA just announced that August was not only the hottest August on record, it was the hottest, tied with July for the hottest month ever on record. So we are entering a period of accelerated warming, and I think in the coming years we will see more and more of these extreme weather events become more frequent.
And yet when you say August was the hottest month on record, for many Americans, probably in their daily lives, they didn't notice that it was much hotter than any other August. You know, it's the heat of the summer, and that's where we were. So do you think that we're going to get to the point where we notice on a daily basis this is much hotter than it usually is at this time of year?
Well, that's a very good question. Based on, polling, the American public's awareness of climate change and the American public's understanding that carbon pollution causes climate change has been rising in the last 2 or 3 years. And I think part of it is they're seeing, weather that we didn't see 30 or 40 years ago. Or as one meteorologist, Jeff Masters, put it, this is not my father's atmosphere. But the biggest changes, there's no question, the biggest changes are in the high latitudes, the Arctic. And we have seen stunning warmth in the Arctic, in the polar regions, as expected. And that has led to rapid warming of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets and projections of sea level rise today that are just considerably higher than anyone thought. So I think, we're starting to see in the vulnerable places, the low-lying places, like, let's say, if you live in the Miami area, you are seeing flooding on perfectly clear days when it's the worst high tide. And it is not a city that is currently set up to deal with the kind of sea level rise that we're going to be seeing over the course of this century, which could be as high as 4, 5, or 6 feet.
Well, how much of the sea level rise at this point is locked in, and when will we see the impacts of that?
So I would say right now, if the world aggressively pursued the plan that was embraced last December by 190 nations unanimously.
In Paris, yes.
Each country came in setting targets in how much they were going to control carbon pollution. But the agreement also says every 5 years we're going to ratchet that down. So if the world follows through, then I think we are going to moderate the impact. We're still going to see them. I mean, we're still going to see the kind of weather and droughts and a moderate amount of sea level rise, but we're going to keep the change at the low end of the dangerous level, and it's going to be slower. On the other hand, if the world were, you know, to not follow through and keep ratcheting down emissions, then I think, you know, you're going to see impacts that will last for centuries that are going to transform the lives of your children and grandchildren.
And how long do we have left, in your view, to really start dealing with the problem before it's too late and all the effects will just happen and we'll have to adapt to them?
Well, we're on a knife's edge for sure. You may have heard the statement, we only have 5 to 10 years to act. And what Paris bought us was those 5 to 10 years. So we're sitting here and we have to deliver. The U.S. has to deliver on its commitment to reduce carbon pollution, about 26% to 28% by 2025 compared to recent levels. And the other nations have to deliver their commitments. And then we have to make further commitments for 2030s and 2040s and 2050s. Now, I want to be clear. The droughts and the superstorms that you're now seeing, we're going to continue seeing them. The question is whether we're going to see them, let's say, Hurricane Sandy every 20 years versus every other year, which is where we are headed according to the science. Coastal property values are headed for a crash because we have a lot of property in a lot of places where it will not be savable in the coming decades. And at some point, people are going to realize that. And insurance companies, mortgage companies won't give you a 30-year mortgage. And so there are transformations coming. That's why I said, you know, what is going to happen in the next 25 years is going to affect you and your family as much as the internet did in the last 25 years.
I want to ask you about another global environmental problem having to do with the atmosphere, and that would be, and a lot of people know about this, the hole in the ozone layer, which in the 1980s, nearly every country on Earth signed on to 2 treaties to solve that problem, and the result has been called the most successful international environmental agreement to date. First of all, is the ozone layer at all connected to climate change? And is the process of fixing the hole in the ozone layer a good parallel in any way for dealing with global climate change?
There are some linkages between the two, but I think it's best in general if people separate them and think of the effort to save the ozone layer as mostly different. There are certain chemicals that we use that harm both. And there are certain interplays between the two. But I think essentially one should think of them as different. Obviously, the ozone layer protects us from ultraviolet rays. And it is clear that this global effort has averted millions and millions of skin cancers and other problems. And yes, I think it's a pretty good analogy in the sense that the United States unilaterally banned all chlorofluorocarbons in aerosol spray cans before the rest of the world acted. That was a very big deal. Nowadays people say, oh, unilateral action, you're weak or, that's not the way countries act. The fact is that we set the example then. The nations of the world started to discuss, will we act? Then scientists found this ozone hole, which just stunned them. And that led to the Montreal Protocol, and that led to a series of ratcheting downs. And by the way, the rich countries went first. That was the deal in the Montreal Protocol. So, here we are today. The nations of the world are, I think, at a similar point to where 1985 was, which is, it's pretty clear that what the scientists said would happen were right, and therefore we better listen to them about what the future holds.
But the answer is not quite as simple, is it, this time as it was with getting rid of CFCs?
No, absolutely not. Chlorofluorocarbons were a set of chemicals. They were incredibly widely used because we thought they were safe. But obviously nothing is as ubiquitous as energy. Every single thing we do involves energy. Either it involves the energy of the electricity of our lighting, heating and cooling, or driving a car, or simply the embedded energy in making the glass or steel for our computers and laptops. So yes, on the other hand, the primary places that produce a lot of energy, there aren't that many. I mean, you know, if you look at the number of fossil fuel powered power plants in this country, we are talking about several hundred. So, yes, this is a bigger challenge than the Montreal Protocol. On the other hand, it is also a bigger threat. You know, there's no question losing the ozone layer would have been, you know, catastrophic to humanity. But that's nothing compared to, let's say, turning a third of the habited landmass into a dust bowl, or 6-7 feet of sea level rise, or, you know, acidifying the ocean to the point where large amounts of life simply can't operate there. So, yeah, we're dealing with a existential threat to humanity. And, you know, by the way, the other good piece of news, you know, you may recall during the debate over the Montreal Protocol, industry said, oh, we can't change it. These are wonder chemicals. There's nothing that can possibly replace them. And then ultimately, when they were forced to, they said, oh, my, look, there's all these substitutes, some of which are cheaper and superior. So we're now at the point, you know, 20 years ago, people said, oh, you can't replace fossil fuels. Well, you know, I was acting assistant secretary for energy efficiency and renewable energy. And we knew that if you invested in solar and wind and batteries and electric cars and LED lighting, that you would get these transformational technologies. And here they are. And we are in the midst of an energy revolution. We have seen the price of solar power come down by a factor of 150 in a quarter century. So we're in the midst of a transformation that gives us the technologies needed to keep ratcheting down emissions. Whether humanity chooses to continue and accelerate the policies to A, use the clean technologies, and B, start an orderly process of, you know, shutting down coal plants and moving off of fossil fuels, that is still in the political realm. I'm just here to tell you we can definitely do it, but aggressive action is needed.
Joseph Rome, author of the book Climate Change, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's also a physicist and founding editor of climateprogress.org. Joseph, thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Jeremy.
And join us tomorrow as our series continues with the politics of climate change.
The city of Lorain, Ohio, has struggled for years. Once a thriving steel town, the Lake Erie community of 64,000 now has a poverty rate of 28%, and unemployment is above 8%. And that has city officials looking for an economic revival. Matt Richmond of Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream reports.
Watch the post.
On a recent Saturday afternoon, 642 Broadway in Lorain's Commercial Center is a hive of activity.
Come back, come back, come back.
Teenagers load a giant cardboard fish onto a wooden platform sitting on the side of the road. The kids are helping build the centerpiece of the second annual Firefish Festival. James Levin, founder of the Cleveland Public Theater, launched the festival. He says the idea is to bring people into downtown Lorain, even if it's just for a night.
We're going to be putting performers on fire escapes and balconies, and people just have a kind of a glow when they experience that kind of stuff. It's a different experience than putting like a rock band on a stage in the middle of a field.
The festival's ambitions have grown in its second year, and so has Levin's vision for Lorain. Beyond the shuttered storefronts and neglected buildings, he sees the potential to make this city a regional arts destination.
Assuming that there are cafes and boutiques and theater and dance and music available here, I think it will draw people eventually.
It's been an especially rough year for Lorain. The Republic Steel Mill shut down. U.S. Steel is down from employing thousands in its heyday to a staff of a few hundred. A budget shortfall led to fire department and city worker layoffs. Lorain Mayor Chase Rittenour says this has been the toughest year since he became mayor in 2012.
You try to inch your way. You try to get these small victories to get to where we ultimately want it to be. You know, there's no magic solution to any of this.
The city has had to be creative. To do that, it's turned to the city's Port Authority. Director Rick Novak says, like the city, the Port Authority had to shift its focus from the industries that long defined Lorain.
We deal with both the maritime industry, we deal with public accessibility, and we deal with economic development. And we work hand-in-hand with the city on trying to revitalize the community as a whole.
The Port Authority can do things the city can't do, like turn over control of a property to a developer without a public bidding process. Mayor Rittenour says the city took over properties during economic downturns with often unrealistic hopes of developing them when the economy improved.
We own dozens and dozens of buildings, and it's not just commercial. I would like to see us sell those to individuals or companies that are going to bring positive to the downtown area.
The 530 Shop on Broadway has been in the Elke family since 1927. It's an antique and collectible shop, a surprising collection of furniture, jewelry, and old-fashioned signs. The current owner, Jane Elke, is optimistic about where the city's headed.
It's a turning point. We've had enough of how it's been, and we're doing all we can, not just me, but the other business owners, to take it forward.
The Port Authority recently took ownership of a historic building near the waterfront, and after years of false starts, leased it to a developer from Chicago. The city is also working on changing its land use laws to move on from an industrial history to an arts and entertainment getaway just west of Cleveland. For Here and Now, I'm Matt Richmond.
The suspect in Saturday's bombing in New York is in custody. Ahmed Khan Rahami was arrested in New Jersey today after a shootout with police. He was sought in connection with the blast in Chelsea Saturday night, but also in connection with other bombs found in New York and New Jersey. Meantime, in Minnesota, authorities say they are investigating the weekend stabbing of 9 people at a mall as a potential act of terrorism. The suspect in that case was shot and killed by an off-duty police officer at the mall. So let's talk about all of this with Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. Seth, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So obviously, different cases in terms of what's going on in New York and Minnesota, but what's your initial reaction to what we're seeing?
Well, it's hard right now with the limited available evidence we have to connect all of the dots, but what we do see at least is two things. One is potentially connection between New York and New Jersey, with the same individual, Ahmed Khan Rahami. And second, we do see potentially a broader connection to violent extremist activity in multiple locations. Again, it's not clear whether it's directly connected and there was joint communication, but at least it's individuals that are committed to conducting violent activity, either through pressure cooker type bombs or stabbings, in the name of a broader cause.
Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit more. I mean, just more directly, do you see anything in these cases that may tell you that this is a response to the call by ISIS for lone wolf attacks in the U.S.?
ISIS has been calling for lone wolf attacks, including in its magazine, Dabiq, for a long time. Its tempo has probably increased a little bit. It's also been encouraging on various social media platforms. Again, it's unclear right now the motivations based on what we know of Ahmed Khan Rahami in the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area. But it does look like both the actions in Minnesota and the announcement by ISIS suggests that there may be at least in some connection, whether inspired or direct. Still going to require a lot of intelligence collection analysis. But again, I think the New Jersey, New York motivation is still unclear.
Okay. I mean, your point is well taken that we're still early in the investigation here. But I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective, do you see any of this connected to the fact that ISIS seems to be losing territory in places like Iraq and Syria?
It's possible. ISIS has lost territory in, actually, even in a broader expanse. It's lost territory not just in Iraq and Syria, but in Libya, including parts of Sirte near the Mediterranean coast. It's lost it in Afghanistan. It now only controls a tiny area in Nangarhar province. And they've called for a broader expansion of violence outside of areas where they control territory, so specifically in Europe and in North America. We've seen other groups, when they lose territory, operate this way, where they, in a sense, decline as insurgent groups that control territory and become increasingly active as terrorist groups that start striking civilian targets. The pattern we've seen most recently in Al-Shabaab activity in Somalia, where it's territory declined and then it ramped up activity against its neighbors, including the Kenyans. So it's certainly possible that's what we're seeing ISIS do now.
So about the actual type of explosives that were used in New York and New Jersey, the pipe bomb blast in a town on the Jersey Shore, and then the unexploded device found in New York on Saturday was a pressure cooker bomb. Now, arguably, those are less sophisticated explosives than, you know, the large explosives that were used, say, in Brussels at the airport there, or, you know, suicide vests that are used elsewhere. So does that tell you anything in terms of who might be doing this in the United States and the vulnerabilities that we have?
Well, look, I mean, these aren't entirely unsophisticated types of attacks. You know, the fact that there was a device that was constructed with a cellular phone as a timer and then Christmas lights as an initiator, I think indicate a slightly higher than average level of competence. The fact that it didn't go off, at least to the degree that that it could have, and the fact that no one was killed, either tells me that one, that it was somewhat of an incompetent individual in the selection of targets, or two, that there was an active decision not to kill large numbers of people. But I think what all of that likely indicates, and we've seen it in a few historical cases, is that this was probably not a direct involved attack by a group like ISIS. This is the levels of sophistication were medium, but not high the way we saw with much more competent attacks in Paris and Belgium.
Mm. So what are the most important questions that you and folks in your world are asking right now?
Who is this individual? Who was he in contact with? How big is the cell structure? Was he acting alone? And who was he in communication? And what were his motivations? Was this someone that was inspired by an extremist ideology like the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda? Was this someone motivated by something else, personal troubles? But it is important at this stage to also begin to unpack the spider web of individuals, if there is one, that were potentially involved in various ways, because that would, you know, if it's just a lone individual, then capturing him means that this is at least partially solved. If it's not, that's a much wider and much more complicated web.
Well, Seth Jones is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, there were some familiar winners at the Emmys last night. Game of Thrones won again for Best Drama. Veep won for Best Comedy. Both shows are on HBO. FX's The People vs. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story, also took home several awards. And there were some funny moments, starting with this cameo by Jeb Bush, who played a limo driver who briefly picked up host Jimmy Kimmel on the way to the Emmys.
Hey, you're driving?
Yeah, I'm in between jobs right now. You know, you can make $12 an hour driving for Uber.
I did not know that, but that's great. I have to get downtown to the Emmys.
Are you nominated?
I am, yeah.
Wow. What's that like?
It's nice. It's nice.
You think you can win?
Well, there's a lot of competition, and probably not.
Well, here's what I know. If you run a positive campaign, the voters ultimately will make the right choice.
You know, it's funny you say that. My sidekick...
Jimmy, that was a joke. Get out of the car.
At one point in the show, some representatives from the accounting firm Ernst & Young appeared on stage to talk about their job keeping the Emmy winners a secret. And Saturday Night Live's Leslie Jones, who's been in a high-profile fight with Twitter trolls and was recently hacked, joined them.
Y'all protected something that nobody is trying to steal. Don't nobody want to know about boring Emmy secrets. Okay, but since you good at keeping things safe, I got a job for you. My Twitter account. Put that in the vault, please. Y'all over here using your skills to protect best voiceover in a French sitcom. Meanwhile, I'm butt naked on CNN.
Perhaps the most bittersweet speech of the night came from Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who won her fifth consecutive Best Actress Award for her role on Veep. She started with politics.
I'd also like to take this opportunity to personally apologize for the current political climate. I think that Veep has torn down the wall between comedy and politics. Our show started out as a political satire, but it now feels more like a sobering documentary. So I certainly do promise to rebuild that wall and make Mexico pay for it. Lastly, I'd like to dedicate this to my father, William Louis Dreyfus, who passed away on Friday. And I'm so glad that he liked me, because his opinion was the one that really mattered. Thank you.
Julia Louis Dreyfus speaking at the Emmys last night, and you're listening to Here and Now. And who do you think has more leisure time, the rich or the poor? Well, according to an economist from the University of Chicago, it's the poor. Joining us now for more is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, who joins us each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So tell us what this economist found.
This economist found something really interesting when you put it in the context of economic predictions from the past. There's a famous 1930 essay by the famous economist John Maynard Keynes, Economic Possibilities of Our Children, in which he essentially said we're going to have a much shorter work week because we're going to be so much richer that we won't have to work so much. So extrapolating from that, one would think that it is the richest who would be able to, quote, buy, unquote, the most leisure time. But in fact, what this economist Eric Hurst at the University of Chicago found was that it is the low-skilled poor, particularly men, those who did not go to college, who have the fastest growing leisure time. 22% of them, of these men without a college degree in their 20s, had not worked at all in the previous 12 months. This in at a time when the unemployment rate has fallen to 5% and sometimes below. So it really is a staggering and shocking statistic.
Well, when you say leisure time, what do we know about what these people are doing with their time?
Leisure time is – leisure is this enormous grab-all category. It includes sleeping. It includes – it can include child care, which as many parents can attest is not particularly leisurely sometimes. And it also includes watching television, playing video games, that which we would more normally associate with leisure. And indeed, it appears that the vast majority of this increase in leisure time, about three-quarters of it, is being soaked up by television and video games. So you have a lot of men who, you know, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, would have been the absolute marrow of the workforce, who now are increasingly staying at home and not only not looking for work, but rather playing video games and watching television. It is not at all what economists from several decades ago would have predicted.
And what's happening with the rich in terms of their leisure time?
Meanwhile, right, this is shocking in two ways. It turns out that elite men, rich men, are the world's chief workaholics. They work longer hours than poor men in the U.S. Their hours are increasing decade over decade, even as they get richer. I love this quote from the economist Robert Frank, who said, "Building wealth to them, these elite rich men, building wealth to them is a creative process and the closest thing they have to fun," which is a little bit sad. But it is rather surprising to think that work hours should increase among this demographic that should theoretically be able to work less on account of their wealth.
What about general happiness? Have they measured that among these two groups, the rich and the poor, and how happy they are with the amount of leisure time that they have or if they're home playing video games?
Well, certainly one of the surprising things that Eric Hurst found, this economist at the University of Chicago, is that the non-working poor, these young men in their 20s, seem to be happier than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when they were much more likely to be working. On the one hand, I think it's a good thing that somebody can be in poverty in the U.S. and not miserable. I think it's a hallmark of a decent society that somebody can not have a job and yet also not necessarily be miserable. But at the same time, one has to think that in 10 or 20 years, these men have pulled themselves out of not only the labor force but also the dating pool. What circumstance are we going to have when these men are 30, 40, 50? It is a little bit concerning, not only for, you know, economists, but also you look right now at the political scene and what happens when there's a large swath of the American electorate that's extremely dissatisfied with the status quo. They can react in sometimes unpredictable ways.
Derek, before I let you go, I want to ask you about something else, because I know you've been going through the recent census numbers that came out about median incomes in the United States, which were up in the last survey across the country. But the metro area that saw the most income growth was Atlanta. Why is that?
Yeah, real outlier. You have Atlanta at the top of the list. The rest of the list is sort of your usual suspects: Portland, Seattle, San Francisco. Why Atlanta? Here's a theory. You have a narrative that's gone on that says that all of the educated people are moving into downtown areas. They're all moving to New York, San Francisco, Washington D.C., and Seattle. To a certain extent, this is true among young people, but the general migration pattern among people in their 30s, 40s, and above is toward the Sun Belt. That stretches from Georgia through New Mexico and Arizona. A lot of people are moving to Atlanta, a lot of really smart people who don't necessarily want to pay, you know, $2,000 for a cardboard box in Manhattan, which is, in fact, the going rate. And so I think that, you know, Atlanta and a couple other cities, metro areas in the Sun Belt, are going to be beneficiaries of the fact that some of the richest coastal metros have locked out the lower middle class and the middle class. And so you're going to have a lot of the next wave of college graduates, I would suspect, are going to settle in cities like Atlanta, which is going to have a positive impact on its median income growth.
Reminds me, I was in Atlanta a couple of years ago and somebody said, you know, we're changing. We all know we're changing. We just don't know where we're going as a city. So we'll see where Atlanta is going. Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.